The U.S. is out, but World Cup fever continues. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown here with Thomas Bradley. This week we'll catch up on the Blue Jackets' busy offseason and see if they're better or worse than last season's playoff team.
And the Ohio State football team lands two more five-star recruits. We'll talk to a reporter about that and about Braxton Miller's health.
But first, Thomas, throw that piece of paper at me. Who am I?
Crazy person?
Tim Howard. Tim Howard, come on. America's hero.
Sam Howard can save anything.
American hero. The U.S. goalkeeper did everything he could and made 16 key saves on Tuesday. Not quite enough, though. The U.S. still lost to Belgium 2-1 in extra time and is out of World Cup play. Heartbreaker of a game.
It was a heartbreaker. The U.S. was able to minimize, actually eliminate damage from Belgium the entire game. They went into extra time at 0-0, and that was all thanks to goalkeeper Tim Howard. He set a modern-day World Cup record, most saves in a World Cup game in 50 years, and that was 16. And the Belgium attack was relentless. They had shots on goal just about every time you turned around. They had the ball in the attacking third four or five times more than the U.S. did, and they were able to score two goals in the 30 minutes of extra time. And then the U.S. and Julian Green were able to score one to equalize. Then they had a great chance with about 3 to 4 minutes to go in the game and couldn't quite convert. It was a heartbreaker for the U.S. They almost came back and forced penalties, but in the end, Belgium moves on and the U.S. is headed home.
I tried to tweet you during the game, but Tim Howard blocked it. Didn't get to. Do you still have World Cup fever? Are you still excited? Are you still pumped to watch Brazil and Germany and all these other teams going into the quarterfinals?
I do. I think I told you this earlier. Soccer does the service to me of leaving me alone for 4 years in a row. So I do it justice, and I really do get into the World Cup. And I knew because I'd done my research and I looked around, and quite frankly, Jurgen Klinsmann knew that the U.S. didn't really stand a chance to win the whole World Cup. If they're going to make it out of the group of death, that was going to be an accomplishment, and then they're going to take it one game at a time. But realistically, there was no chance for USA to win the World Cup.
They could beat anyone on any given day, but they couldn't put together a string of wins like that.
Exactly. I think that's a fair point. So I am still excited about the World Cup. I'm excited to see how the powerhouses that are left do in Germany and Brazil. And I'm excited about the Netherlands and Costa Rica and France and all these other teams that are still in. Every group winner from the group stages advanced in the quarterfinals. So there was no two seed that upset a one seed from the other group. So no big real surprises. First time that's happened in World Cup history. But all eight of the group winners have moved on to the round of eight. And it should be an exciting finish.
You're helping me make my point that I don't really think anyone, or very few people, really fell in love with soccer, and they'll start following Chelsea or Everton or Manchester United in the English Premier League. I don't really think soccer made that leap, that regardless of what most of the sports media wants.
We talk about it every 4 years, whether soccer is going to be the new best thing. I think soccer has a chance, but I think Keith Olbermann on ESPN on his show said it best. He has a video that's kind of going viral right now, and he has seven suggestions to make soccer work in the U.S. He prefaces that he doesn't care if it works. He doesn't care because he's Keith Olbermann. Go ahead and watch it. He's a little into himself, but I think that the suggestions are valid. He says that soccer needs to start to have its own identity in the United States.
Shorten the field.
Maybe shorten the field. Make it U.S. soccer. Stop having British announcers. Stop pretending that USA have the ball and that they're playing on a pitch and their uniforms are called kits. And stop being British. This is the United States. If you want soccer to work, make it work for the United States, and I agree with that point. He also said that they have a great great asset in that soccer video games in the United States are more popular than baseball and basketball games, with the only—
You can't play NCAA football anymore at all.
Well, that's exactly right. And so FIFA soccer, before most people don't even know FIFA is an actual organization that is this worldwide conglomerate of all these soccer programs. They see it as the cover of a video game that they play. So the United States has a rare opportunity to make soccer prominent, and I think if they go in the right direction and start to make it their own and not try to copy everyone else, I think soccer has a real chance, especially with the younger generation coming up, to overpass baseball as one of the big four sports. Baseball is declining. It takes 4 hours to play a game in the American League.
Yeah, soccer, what, 90-minute game? I mean, 90 minutes and on-field time. But
you know how much time a soccer game is going to be. There's no ridiculous time because the clock runs. So you have a set time. If there's extra time, there's extra time. People are always like, oh, we can't have a tie in the United States. Well, then make a rule in United States soccer that there can't be a tie, and every game has to end in penalty kicks. If that's what you need to do to make soccer popular in the United States, then do it.
Unless it's a baseball all-star game, then they can tie.
Baseball all-star games can tie, apparently, right. And Donovan McNabb can tie in his games, too.
Soccer did really well on TV in the U.S. It did especially well in Columbus, the second highest per capita TV ratings in the country, just behind D.C.
Yeah, it did. Columbus had a great market share, and I think that has to do with the popularity. I think that has to do with the popularity of the Columbus Crew and of course, our show. There's a lot of passionate soccer fans. It's kind of become the hip thing to do for younger people in Columbus to really enjoy soccer and really enjoy Columbus Crew soccer. Columbus always does well in sports market and TV viewership. It's a sports town. If there's something trendy happening in sports, Columbus is going to be at the front of that and in the front in the TV ratings as well.
From soccer to hockey.
The Blue Jackets have been busy this offseason.
Busy letting players go. Zing.
Shut up, Steve.
I know. They have let a lot of players go. They've been busy with the draft, too, as well. Free agency trades. For more, we called Columbus Dispatch reporter Aaron Portsline. We started with contract negotiations for one of the Jackets' best young players. Aaron, starting off with Ryan Johansson, where are negotiations with him?
They are at a standstill, an impasse, if you will. The Blue Jackets want a bridge deal, a 2 or 3 year contract that would leave Ryan Johansson a restricted free agent for his next contract signing. The player and his agent, Kurt Overhart, want a long-term deal, and they seem quite offended at the notion that the Blue Jackets want a bridge deal. So they're at an impasse because they can't even reach common ground on how long the contract should be, never mind the dollars that will be paid.
Is there precedent for him demanding a long-term contract at this early of an age?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's precedent for demanding it. There's not a lot for getting it. I mean, players like Sidney Crosby, the truly exceptional, generational-type players, yes. A lot of players, I mean, the most recent example of this is the great young defenseman in Montreal, P.K. Subban, who did accept a bridge contract. And for 2 years was paid at a rate that the Canadians thought was reasonable. Now they're going to pay for it because he's had two tremendous seasons and is going to sign a monster deal later this summer.
Right.
So let's get to the players who have already left. Jack Skilly, Blake Como, Derek McKenzie, and Nikita Nikitin. And the Jackets haven't signed anyone. Is this all part of a strategy?
Yeah, well, the plan was to grow from within, and they've reached the point now where they've got plenty of players ready to come in. With Nikitin, they weren't going to re-sign him. They felt like they had better options inside the organization. Dalton Prout, David Savard, both third-pairing defensemen who will eat up his minutes easily, they believe. And Tim Erickson and Cody Goloboff. There's two young players who are pushing for that number 7 spot early in training camp. So they feel like they're very, very in good shape for defensively. And then at forward, you mentioned Como and McKenzie and Skilly. All of these players were elite, allowed to test free agency, ultimately to leave. They've signed with other clubs. And the Blue Jackets have Mark Letestu at center. They have Jared Bull coming back healthy on the right side. And they've got two players that they like a lot, Corey Tropp and Jerry DiMigo, who they just acquired in a trade with Toronto. So they think they're covering the fourth line, and they also like the fact that they're leaving open the door for some of their young talent. And they've got a lot of young high-end forwards that they don't want those kids coming to camp thinking they have no shot to make the hockey club. Now they come to camp with the possibility. There's some flexibility in the lower part of the forward lineup, which is exactly what they wanted to achieve.
One of the guys that was normally a face of the Blue Jackets has now departed to Philadelphia. RJ Umberger is in Philly in exchange for Scott Hartnell. Talk about the trade for Hartsey.
Yeah, well, this is a wonderful escape plan almost by Jarmo Kekalainen and the Blue Jackets. When a player requests a trade and the whole world knows about it, typically the offers you get for that player are far below his market value. In this case, and this isn't just me speaking, but several people around the league concur, that to be able to flip RJ Umberger for a player of Scott Hartnell's capabilities, that this is a proven top six forward. This is a guy who has played with the great Alexander Giroux in Philadelphia the last few years at 37 goals just 2 years ago. Very talented player. They think it's an upgrade on Umberger. Now, the reason the Flyers were willing to trade him is Hartnell has a five-year contract at $4.75 million. Umberger's term is shorter, 3 years, $4.6 million. But the Blue Jackets think they're getting a better player and a player who fits their needs, top six left winger, and the style of this club, a real gritty, hardworking player. They think he fits perfectly.
Let's get to the draft now. Sonny Milano was the Blue Jackets' first-round pick at number 16 overall. He's committed to play college hockey next year. How exactly does that work, and when can we expect to see him in Columbus?
Yeah, well, first I must say that is Frank Sonny Milano to you, boys.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. And he is committed only if you put your fingers in the air and sort of wink them, putting the word committed in quote marks. He is expected to go to college. He's told Boston College he's going to go to college. Everybody I talked to at the draft in Philadelphia was of strong belief that he was going to go the Canadian junior route. And that's not a bad plan if you care only about the player's hockey ability. That is very much like a pro system. They play 70-plus games. He would be going to a very good program in the junior ranks. And so the Blue Jackets would be fine with either of those. They will let the player decide. They will sit down with the player and his family if they wish. They have made it clear they're not going to try to persuade him one way or the other, but they're happy with either of his options. He's in a really good situation and could reasonably be expected to turn pro within a couple years. He's got an elite set of skills. All you have to do is look on the internet, look up Sonny Milano, S-O-N-N-Y Milano, and there are highlight films of this kid everywhere. He's a pretty rare talent.
Was he a surprise the Blue Jackets were able to get him at pick 16, or is that about where he was going to fall?
Well, you know, every GM comes away from the draft saying that they're delighted where they got a guy. I think that's about where Milano was expected to go. What concerns people about him, and this is what makes drafting 18-year-olds so difficult, is he's not a big kid, 5'11", 180 pounds. He certainly is in good shape, but he's on the small side right now. He needs to fill out. But what they love about this kid and what gives them great confidence that he's going to become an NHL player is he is absolutely possessed and driven by the sport of hockey. Like, he's one of those what they call rink rats, where they have to basically tell him to get off the ice because the Zamboni's going to run him over if he doesn't get off the ice. He just loves to be out there, loves to play, and is committed to being an NHL hockey player.
Pending disaster with the Johansson dealings, where do the Blue Jackets sit right now? Are they a better team than they were at the end of last season, or are they a worse team?
Well, I think they're a better team. So much of the growth is going to come from within the organization. That's really what has to happen when you're the youngest team in the NHL. I think Scott Hartnell makes them better. He makes them more formidable in their top six. But you've got all these young players. Ryan Johansson should be a better player next year than he was last year. Boone Jenner, his rookie season was beyond expectations. He's expected to be better next year. They've got a lot of those guys. Ryan Murray. And the biggest issue that is easy to forget about, their big free agent acquisition of last year, Nathan Horton, was not really Nathan Horton at all last year because of the he had a major shoulder surgery last summer at this time, and it took him until January before he was able to play. And then he injured a knee and tried to play through that. This was not the rough and tumble, bowl people over Nathan Horton that people have come to know. And now the Blue Jackets have him. They've got Scott Hartnell both added into their top six. It's a different team. It's a more formidable team. And I would suggest that they are a better team than they were a year ago.
We've been talking about the Blue Jackets offseason with Columbus Dispatch beat writer Aaron Portsline. Thanks again, Aaron.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
We can talk about all the soccer and hockey we want, but this is an OSU football town.
It's always football season in Columbus, we know that. OSU coaches have landed some big recruits. Braxton Miller still healing as well. For more on that and everything else about OSU football, we called Ben Axelrod from Buckeye Sports Bulletin. Ben, before we get into recruiting, first of all, the Big Ten is saved, right? We have Rutgers in Maryland now. We're fine.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but yeah, as of July 1st, both Rutgers and Maryland have officially joined the Big Ten. You saw the mascots out in Washington, D.C., kind of officially welcoming those two programs. I think Maryland makes a little more sense than most people give them credit for. They are actually doing pretty well on the recruiting trail, and they've taken some kids from Ohio State, actually, in the past few years, and they have the potential both in men's basketball and in football to be, kind of upper-level college programs. Rutgers, to me, doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I don't think it makes sense to a lot of people. I know they want the quote-unquote New York market, and I'm not even sure how much Rutgers over in New Jersey brings when it comes to that. But, yeah, we got two new programs in the Big Ten up to, 14, 16 teams now. So, yeah, Big Ten's growing.
Big week for Ohio State in recruiting. On Wednesday, they grabbed 2 5-star recruits, both of them friends, one from Minnesota and Jay Sean Cornell, and the other, the top player in Ohio, Justin Hilliard from St. X in Cincinnati. Ben, how big is that, and can this provide momentum for the rest of the recruiting season?
Well, it could carry a ton of momentum. You've got a couple of other prospects, Damian Harris and LJ Scott, set to make their decisions here in the next few weeks, as well as Jerome Baker up in Cleveland. So, yesterday was a huge day for the Buckeyes in terms of recruiting, picking up, like you said, Justin Hilliard from Cincinnati, and then Jay Sean Cornell, the number one player overall in Minnesota. And these are two kids who kind of fancy themselves as the next Ray Lewis and Terrell Suggs when it comes to defense. And I actually saw Urban Meyer yesterday, and I don't think I've seen him smile that big since the Michigan win. So, big day for the Buckeyes, definitely, in terms of momentum on the recruiting trail.
Where does their 2015 class stack up right now as it sits?
It's about top 10. I think us as scout have them at 11 right now, which is, a huge jump from where they were. I mean, just May 1st, they were sitting, in the 50s on the verge of being unranked with pretty much only two committed prospects. They're climbing, and they're in the lower double digits now when it comes to commits, and this class is probably only going to get to about 20 kids, if that. So it's climbing, and this is going to be a big month. This could be as big of a month as we see for the Buckeyes on the recruiting trail until that final home stretch from January to February before National Signing Day.
Looking at Ohio State's schedule this year, obviously they've got Maryland, which is new to the Big Ten, but there's a lack of a couple powerhouse teams for Ohio State. Talk about their schedule and how that could play into another perfect regular season.
Well, I think their out-of-conference schedule is actually, one of the tougher ones that they've had in recent years. When you talk about Virginia Tech and Cincinnati both coming to the Horseshoe, that's going to be Cincinnati's Super Bowl, and Virginia Tech's going to be breaking in a new quarterback. But that's a program that's been, a really, really strong program for the last 15 years here. Both of those are going to be night games at the Shoe, and as we've seen here before with Penn State and USC, anything can happen under the lights. Then you're right. If they can get out of the out-of-conference schedule unscathed, then the Big Ten schedule sets up really nicely, and it should be an easy path to November 8th in East Lansing, Michigan, where they'll face Michigan State. That's going to be maybe the biggest game, you could argue, of the college football season, really, this year, when you just look at those two programs and what happened last year in Indianapolis. And if Ohio State's undefeated heading into that game, that's going to be its one major roadblock before getting back to Indianapolis after the Michigan game.
You talked about Cincinnati. You mentioned it's their Super Bowl. Like, how would Ohio State hear the end from Cincinnati fans and the rest of programs in Ohio if they were somehow to lose that game?
No, of course not. I mean, I think we saw a little bit of that with Ohio State and Dayton in the NCAA tournament. You know, every other college program in the state of Ohio, for lack of a better cliche, is Ohio State's little brother, and they're all kind of nipping at Ohio State's heels. And if one can knock them off, then, you know, that's arguably the biggest day in their program sometimes.
Ben, looking at the current roster, Braxton Miller, star quarterback, did not play in the spring game because of surgery. How's he doing?
He's, I asked Urban Meyer about that yesterday, and he's throwing and he's working out, but he's not 100%. I don't think he'd be able to play if there was a game this upcoming week. But Urban said he's close, and all indications are that he's going to be ready for training camp here at the start of August. And, you know, that's big for the Buckeyes. I think that Braxton missed out really this spring, not being able to work in this offense, because this offense is going to look a lot different without Carlos Hyde. But Urban had really, really positive things to say about the strides that Braxton Miller has made really since Urban's came here. And he's right. If you look just season to season, the way he's grown, if he can make another one of those leaps for Ohio State this year, you know, the sky's the limit for this team. You know, that's kind of the million-dollar question when it comes to Ohio State this season is, what's Braxton Miller going to be able to do? Because we did see him struggle at the end of last season. But if he can return to, you know, being a Heisman-caliber candidate, then this Ohio State team is going to be right there in the national title hunt.
We've been talking about Ohio State football with Buckeye Sports Bulletin reporter Ben Axelrod. Ben, thanks as always.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can always find the show at WOSU.org/afterthescore and by using the WOSU Public Media mobile app.
You can also find the show on iTunes and follow up on Twitter @AfterTheScore. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.